So thank you for the last minute invitation, and thank you for the opportunity. Are you listening well? Okay, I'm not sure. Okay, so the first, I think all the concepts that I will talk have been mentioned before today to be more from a different perspective and maybe just a different notation and a different explanation. And I have like, I think 13 slides of more methods, explanations, and then a lot of applications that I think this will be the newer and most interesting part of the talk. So I won't spend a lot of time in the theory because I think people have stressed it quite a lot during today. So I will talk about my current work at the Institute of Psychiatry, King's College, London, and I've been using machine learning methods to analyze fMRI data with the aim of having clinical classification. To start, just to introduce the concept that has been already introduced a couple of times today, is pattern recognition is a field within the area of machine learning, and when we have number of examples of input and output, when we do not have a very good mathematical model to compute this relationship, we can use learning methodology. It means we learn from a series of examples. So we have a set of training examples, and we can use an algorithm to learn this mapping between input and output during the training phase, and after, during the test phase, we can make predictions to a new example. So this is the general framework. There are a number of different machine learning methods, Gaussian process, Bayesian networks, naive. There are many that were mentioned today, but I will specifically concentrate and support vector machine. That is a method that I have been mainly using. And SVM is based on statistical learning theory and is a powerful pattern recognition approach and has been used in different applications and microarray classification, and I will specifically talk about fMRI data analysis. So I always like to compare these with the standard way of analyzing fMRI data. In the standard approach, we use, normally people use mass univariate analysis where a GLM model is fitted to each voxel time series. We estimate some parameters, we apply some statistical tests, and the output is a statistical parametric mapping showing regions more activated in one condition in relation to the other. In the pattern recognition approach, is different because it's a multivariate approach. So instead of looking at each voxel individually, we look at the whole pattern of activation during one and the other condition. And during the train, we try to identify the discriminating pattern between the two groups, and then we use this information to predict the class label of a new example. This has been also shown before, the advantage of using multivariate methods, and this I have a very simple toy example with two voxels, and here we can see that in this, in a few cases, if we want to classify these two groups, and in this case where the signal of the voxels, the distribution of the signal is very well separated, we can classify using multivariate methods, but in some cases we need the join information to be able to classify. To give the fMRI data as input to the classifier, it also has been mentioned today that we can use represent the brain volume by a long vector where the dimensionality of this vector is the number of voxels and normally is the order of 100 of 1,000 of voxels within the brain tissue if we use a whole brain approach. And this is a toy example, I think also has been shown a couple of times before. So to illustrate, although we normally classify high-dimensional space, it's much easier to visualize an intuitive example in two dimensions. So we have a two-voxel brain. We acquire two volumes for task one, two volumes for task two. So we can plot each of these volumes as a point in this two-dimensional space. So each volume is a point. We have all four volumes here, and we can train a classifier. So training the classifier can be viewed as a task. Sorry, it's not, okay. I think it's not. working around? Yes. So can be viewed as a task of finding a hyperplane. And during the training, what the classifier does is find this hyperplane that separates the data, and after the training, given you example, we can make a prediction. And there are different approaches to find this hyperplane. And the simplest approach is the linear discriminant. It's very simple, it's based on the mean. We have find the mean or the center of mass for each class, the difference, and then the middle point is the hyperplane. So to classify, we project each of these samples onto the weight vector that is normal to the hyperplane. So we classify the samples belong to one or the other class, depending on the position in relation to the hyperplane. And of course, we have to correct for the within class covariance. This is a very simple classifier, but the disadvantage is this classifier is based on the mean. So the mean is a measure very sensitive to outlier. So it might work well. This type of classifier might work well for the training set. If there are outliers, it might not generalize well for new examples. So we need something more robust that has more a higher generalization. And that's why I've been using the support vector machine. So actually, as Francisco mentioned, in case of fMRI data where we have this high-dimensional voxel space and just few examples, there are many possible classifiers, and the problem is to find the best solution, the optimal classifier. And this is what the support vector machine does. It finds the optimal classifier, and among all hyperplanes separates the data. There is a unique optimal hyperplane, is the one with the largest margin, and here margin is the distance to the closest point, is defined as the distance to the closest point to the hyperplane. So I have this slide shows an intuitive idea why the largest margin classifier is the best or the optimal one. If we consider these 6 points as training examples, and we know that the test examples will be very similar to the training examples, but bounded by a noise R, and we train a classifier, we find this classifier with a margin ho, as long as ho is bigger than R, we can be sure that all testing examples will be corrected classified. We start having problems when R is bigger than ho. But the problem is we don't know R. So the best we can do is to find a classifier with the largest margin as possible. And this classifier is defined by the examples that lie on the margin. They are called support vectors. And yeah, this is the idea of support vector machines. You have this hyperplane defined by the examples that are closest to the hyperplane. And the solution, the optimal hyperplane, is computed by solving a quadratic optimization problem that is minimizing the norm of the weight vector subject to some constraints. And the solution, the hyperplane is defined by a weight vector, and this weight vector is a linear combination of the support vectors. Xi here represents the images or the examples, Y the class label, and alpha the coefficient. So all the examples that have coefficient alpha different from zero are support vectors, and they contribute to the hyperplane. In neuroimaging, the hyperplane has an interpretation. So we look at these weights of the weight vector, and the value of each voxel in the discriminating volume or the weight vector indicates or is related to the importance of these voxels in discriminating the task. And this in this toy example, we have also a two voxel brains and three examples from one class and the other, and we can see that voxel 2 is more important to discriminate than voxel 1. And what happens is when we look at the weight vector, we will see a higher value in voxel 2 in relation to voxel 1. So we can plot these weights as images as we've seen before, and we can have some information about how the classifier uses the information from the features or the voxels to perform the classification. There is a problem is how when we the output of a classifier, we have for each voxel one value. And it's very difficult to decide which are the voxels are important for the classification. So we can arbitrarily threshold these weights, trying to see the peaks of the weight vector and trying to decide which regions are more important for the discrimination. But it's not a very good approach because the classifier actually during the classification is using all voxels. So when we arbitrarily, it's not a good idea to arbitrarily threshold. So we try to investigate some approaches to threshold and to decide which features. And this is quite related with Isabel's talk in the morning about how to select features. We can see the problem of thresholding the weight vector as a problem of finding or feature selection. And I will present two different approaches to address this problem. And one is using recursive feature elimination. This work has been done for by a PhD student working with me. And the idea is to use recursive feature elimination to find a sparse representation of the weight vector. So this is a brief description of the algorithm. We start the SVM with all the voxels, we train once, we rank the features, and then we remove a few voxels. We repeat this procedure and until the point that the accuracy decreases. But we have also used the test margin as being a more precise measure than only the accuracy, that is 0.1. And once the accuracy starts to decrease, it's the moment that we are losing features that are important for the discrimination, so we stop there. And I have an example here. And two data sets, these are the classifications before and after. These procedures for the data sets we tested didn't really change the accuracy. But it might be because we have already a very good classification, so we might be in the ceiling, having a ceiling effect here that we could not improve the classification. But when we look at the weight as maps, you can see that we a much sparser representation by using this method. So it's easier to define which voxels are really important for the discrimination. So this is a non-supervised way of thresholding the weights and finding the most important regions for the discrimination. Another approach that I will show, but is a very, very preliminary, I just decided to show because it is very related to the talk in the morning about the zero-norm SVM. And Isabel, I think, she mentioned this approach. The idea is to have a rescaling vector that you initialize with ones, and then you train the SVM, you find the W, and then you use the W as a rescaling factor to the data. And you repeat this process, this procedure a number of times until you find a stop criteria, until you reach a stop criteria. And I have a few examples, but this is very preliminary, but we can see here running this approach, the number of voxels decreases very strongly in the beginning and then slowly after a few steps, and this is the accuracy, and what I've done here is just I leave one out, and I run, so I had one curve for each of the leave one outs, and this is the average of the results. And just for visualization, I would like to show what happens with the weight in each step. So step one, step two, three, and the green means it's close to zero, and red and blue it's high value. So we see that after a few steps, the weights become very, very sparse, and we see the regions here are regions that are also selected, very similar to the regions selected by the recursive feature elimination method. But what I'm presenting here, and then I am presenting until this step 10, when we just have very few voxels in these weights, but what I'm presenting here is just one of the leave one outs, because what happens is for each cross-validation, actually, you might end up with a different subset of voxels, and then one has to think the best way of combining, and I haven't done any type of combination of these cross-validations so far. It's just I thought it was a good idea to illustrate the method that she mentioned in the morning, how it does work for neuroimaging data. I finished the methods description, and I think now I start showing the what might be newer for people here is just because I have more applications now, just applications. So this is the general framework that I've been using. So I use preprocessing steps, standard fMRI preprocessing steps in SPM, and after I split the data in training and test sets. One can use some dimensionality reduction at this step, and then training and test, and we have two outputs, the accuracy and the discriminating maps. So the first application is a very simple one. Can we classify brain states using whole brain information from different subjects? So in this experiment, it was an emotional experiment, and we had 16 subjects looking at pleasant and unpleasant images. The pleasant images were women in swimsuits, and the unpleasant images were skin disease. And the idea is we have the subjects, 15 subjects, we have 16 subjects. So we train the classifier with the brain formation of 15. Now we have a new subject, and we have the brain image, and we want to say the subject was looking at a pleasant or unpleasant image. And the way, this is just a description of the protocol, just what I would like to emphasize here, that we use it as a training example. We average the blocks. So we had a block design, 7 volumes within the block, we average, and we had a representative example per block. We use a leave-one-out procedure. Here we can see the results for this. We can each row represent a leave-one-out, and each symbol is the classification of a block image. And we can classify with about 90% of accuracy if the new subject is looking at pleasant or unpleasant image, you use information from other subjects. And this is a non-threshold weight vector. The problem in using, I think also Steve mentioned in the morning, there is these transitions, this time points, and there is a certain of assumptions that we have to make when we average the volumes within the block. We have to assume that there is a stationarity within the block, and all the volumes within the block have the same pattern. And we know that it might not be true for some areas in the brain, and we expect it to have a much more, especially in emotional experiments, when we expect to have habituation, adaptation. So we extend this work to use a temporal dimension in the classification. So it's the same experiment now, but the way we are giving the data to the classifier is different. Instead of averaging the volumes within the block, we concatenate all the 7 volumes within the block and the 7 volumes during the fixation. So we created this spatial temporal volume, and we trained the classifier using the spatial and temporal information. So the accuracy using this approach was similar to the accuracy that we obtained before, but now we have also a spatial temporal pattern for the weight vector. So for each time point, we have a weight vector that has space and time. So this is during the block presentation, the figure, the picture presentation, and this is during the fixation. And we can see here that there is a dynamic happening. The weight vector is changing over time. And what I would like to emphasize is that there are some regions, as we can see in the 5th time point here, amygdala, that appears as being discriminating only at this time point and not in the others. The same happens with orbital frontal cortex, is discriminating only a few time points. So if we look at this peaks here and look at the time series trying to understand what was happening in the raw data, we can see that the amygdala activated for both type of stimuli, and there is just one time point here in the 5th time point where one can discriminate this information. So this is an example when it's important to use the temporal information. This gray area is the block, and the white area is the fixation period. And so if we average the time points here, we really lose the information we have. We might have, we lose the temporal information. So this also happens at the orbital frontal cortex. We have this more non-stationary behavior, but if you look at the visual cortex, the behavior is very stationary. So here we can average the results, or either if you average or whatever you do, you normally see visual cortex. The signal-to-noise rate is very strong, and the behavior is very close to the standard hemodynamic response function. I like to show now a second example, because this was a blocker design. We can use the same spatial-temporal approach for an event-related design. And where in this experiment, the subjects had to decide if the objects were the same. And this is a more difficult experiment, because we don't know exactly when the subject is making the decision. So it's a more difficult to give label. We could use the reaction time to label the data, but we use the spatial temporal SVM, giving the whole information to classify. And there were four different conditions. So the subject had to decide if the objects were the same, and the objects were rotated with different angular disparities, 0, so no rotation, 20, 60, and 100. We had 11 subjects, and we trained three different classifiers to discriminate between 0 and 20, 0 and 60, and 0 and 100 angular disparity. And we can see from the accuracy here that the accuracy increases is correlated with the angular disparity. So between 0 and 20, we have about 70% of accuracy. Between 0 and 60, 80%. And between 0 and 100 degree, 90% of accuracy. So it shows that if the tasks are more discriminating, it will be easier also for the support vector machine or the classifier identify these patterns in the brain. And if you look at the weights, we can see that between 0 and 20, 0 versus 60, and 0 versus 100. And we can see that when the tasks are more different, the pattern is clearer. So this pattern, less noise, are well-defined. We can see regions from parietal cortex, and also the regions in red are regions that has been described in the resting state network, that they appear because they have a negative mode. Okay, they have, when the task gets more difficult, they decrease the signal parametrically. So it's just to show that the most discriminant, the patterns, the higher is the angular disparity, the most discriminant the patterns are. We also compare this with the T, and I think this is a very important point when using this multivariate approach, because it's very difficult to know what's really happening in these regions only by looking at the weight vector, because it's a multivariate approach, and what is happening in each of these voxels depends on the whole pattern over the whole brain. So when we compare to the T, we can see some differences. And our hypothesis in this case was that the difference was due to some multivariate structure in the data. So we can see here some differences in between, some peaks that are different. So we try to understand what is happening in the peaks of the weight vectors, if there is some multivariate structure. And to do that, we extract the time series for the peaks, and we compute the change in functional connectivity, just to investigate if there were some multivariate structure. And what we found was that for most of the regions within the mental rotation network, there was a change in connectivity between the 0 and 100 degree conditions. And this change in connectivity, it seems to be something that the SVM is able to find very easily. Now I have some clinical examples of applications of the support vector machine. So instead of classifying tasks or cognitive states, you try to classify groups of subjects, patients versus controls. So the first application we have, we try to classify depressed patients versus controls using a SED facial processing experiment. So in this experiment, this was an event-related experiment. The subjects were looking at emotional expressions, two level, low, medium, and high intensity. We call low, it was happy 0, SED 2, and SED 4 type of stimuli. Because we have the event related and it's very difficult to use the raw data to train and test the classifier, we use the GLM coefficients as training examples, and we had 19 patients and 19 controls. So here we can see the results for the three different tasks, and this was our best result when we were able to classify patients versus controls with 84% of sensitivity and 89% of specificity. And we can look at the weights for one for each of the tasks, but the threshold here is an arbitrary threshold. So the second example that I would like to show is classifying young versus elderly subject. It was a memory experiment. I won't go a lot in the details, but there were five conditions: encoding, retention, retrieval, resting, and visual stimulation. And we train a separate SVM for each of these conditions. And as training examples, we use the mean volume per condition over all blocks in this case. And then we had 10 elderly subjects and 10 healthy controls. And we can see here the classification. We were able to predict, to classify the young subjects with 89% of accuracy and the elderly subjects with 67%. What I think is interesting here is that the young group clusters together is a much more homogeneous group than the elderly population. So this is something we would expect, that people age, some of the elderly people still have the same behavior or the same brain pattern as the young one. So it's something that makes sense what we would expect. And these are the weights. And the retrieval task was the best task for discriminating these groups, the groups in this case. And the last example is classification of drugs versus placebo. This is a more difficult situation because the subjects are the same, the task is the same, but then in one condition they took a scopolamine, and the other condition they took a placebo. And it was a paired associated learning task. And there were three blocks and encoding retrieval in each block, and we trained a separate SVM. We tried different approaches, but the approach that worked better was training classifier in each of these blocks. And the best result was using the encoding block, second and third encoding block, and we were able to classify placebos and the drug and the placebo, the drug with about 70% and the placebo 80%. So it's also here in a case that the placebo, the response to the placebo is more homogeneous than the response to the drug, what also makes sense. So this is just a comparison with the t-test. This is an example that we people also we applied the t-test on this data, and we couldn't find many regions that discriminate between using univariated approach. But when you look at the SVM weight vectors, we were able to find the discrimination in regions like hippocampus that we would expect with the task and the drug. So this is what I had to present, and this is the group I've been working in London with. So thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Do we have any questions for the speaker?
Probably. People have already asked it in the other
session. I actually had one. So in the stuff that you're doing with the SVMs, with the L1 or?
L0? Where's L0?
Oh, I'll ask you afterwards.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, did you have a question?
I have one question. I was wondering how much spatial smoothing you use, and what are your thoughts on the impact of spatial smoothness to the SVM?
Yeah, there is some impact of, I've been actually, okay, I use normally 8 millimeters for fMRI data, just a standard pre-processing step when for multi-subject analysis. But recently I've been interested in using kernels that incorporate the smooth step, like Gaussian kernels, but not in the sample space, but in the voxel space. And I try to compare, because if I've been investigating this, I try to run the same analysis without with smooth step. And for these data sets, for most of these data sets, didn't really change it. But I think I have here, not for the clinical applications, for the first ones, like the mental rotation and emotional. But these data sets have a very high signal-to-noise rate, and the regions are very well defined, and the tasks are quite different. So I think in some situations, the spatial filter is more or less important.
Can we say that the results were the same, the prediction accuracy?
No, it was a little bit lower, but maybe...
Without
smoothing, because it's a multi-subject context.
Right.
In a single subject, I don't think it would really make a difference, or would maybe even make it worse, but in a multi-subject, you would expect more overlapping between the subjects when you apply the spatial filter. But I was surprised that the impact was not as high for these two data sets, the two first that I mentioned, but I think it's because the signal to noise is very high in these data sets, and the regions are visual cortex, a big region, so it's very easy to overlap across subject.
So on behalf of IPAM and the organizers, I'd like to thank all of you for hanging in there to the bitter end, and thank all of our speakers again for the whole conference.